Today my guest is a New York Times best-selling author and an award-winning journalist. He is one of the world's leading experts on high performance. In 2013, his book The Rise of Superman was the first book in history to land on the New York Times bestseller list in the sports, science, psychology, and business category. And today we're very lucky to have him here to talk about his latest book, The Last Tango in Cyberspace. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest is Stephen Cutler. Stephen, how are you?
I'm super good, Yuri. How are you?
I'm doing good as well. I'm very good. I'm very excited about this new project of yours. I mean, you're no stranger to writing successful books, and actually came first time I believe I heard of you was when I picked up a copy of The Rise of the Superman. And now you just embark in this whole new adventure writing fiction. What's up with that?
So my first book is actually a novel. I'm trained as a novelist. Actually, I was trained as a poet, and then I was trained as a novelist. I switched over very quickly right after that. A couple other novels that I wrote that are sitting in drawers that I didn't like. First one did well, won some awards, was a bestseller, but I never felt like I really had control of the form. Like it sort of kicked my ass, it was unfinished business. So, switched over to nonfiction, wrote 10 books, 9 books, and then jumped back into fiction to sort of give it another go, and had a blast. Never had as much fun writing a book as I had writing Last Tango in Cyberspace.
Well, now you have done both. So which one is harder, fiction or nonfiction?
So I think there's all kinds of different challenges. So I'll give you an example. Stealing Fire, my most recent nonfiction book, has like 2 to 3 facts per sentence. It's incredibly fact dense. And so when you're writing something and it had to be that dense, there's just that much information that needs to get conveyed to people. But when you're trying to write something that's that dense and make it really fun to read and lively and all that stuff, that's its own challenge. And it's difficult on a sort of a sentence by sentence basis. The problem with novels, at least for me, I had two problems when I started out. One, you have to make decisions about how you're going to choose to convey emotion. And that's not something you do often in nonfiction. You can elicit emotions in your reader if you know what you're doing skillfully, but actually having to portray emotion and how you're going to deal with that, that's not something you have to do. And that's something that's hard and requires choice and consistency and some thinking. And it's easy to get wrong. It's easy to make characters that are really not believable and emotions that are over the top and all that crap. And the harder part is, so Chekhov had this famous rule about writing where he said, if a character walks into a scene in a bar room in Act 1, and he has to hang his gun on a peg on the wall, because you're not allowed to bring guns into the bar, and he hangs on the wall, every gun you hang on the wall has to be fired by the end of the play. So the idea is that in writing, every idea that you introduce in chapter 1, 2, or 3, or 4 has to be, you have to close every loop by the end. Otherwise, the reader's not satisfied at all. The problem with fiction is it's really hard to control that. Like you get to a point where you're a little stuck or you want to do a stylistic flourish to get through a paragraph. Maybe you introduce a line of dialogue. Maybe a character pops in for a second, something like that. And it doesn't seem like anything at the time. It just seems like a simple plot device. But over time, when you end up with 10, 20, 30, 40 of those things, by the time you get to the end of the book, there's no way to stitch it all back together. So it took me a really long time to learn how to control a novel. And I worked very diligently in this book, kind of outlining in the beginning and scene by scene, mapping everything out so I would not lose control of it, because I felt like I did in my first couple of novels.
Many authors struggle with the idea, even the plot of the book, for months, if not years, before they put into writing. Was that the case for you as well?
It's a funny story. It's a two-part story. Part one is, I wrote a book, my third book was called A Small Furry Prayer. And it's about the relationship between humans and animals, and it's got a lot of environmental content in it. And the book did really, really well, but it did really, really well inside of the environmental movement, inside of the animal movements, inside of dog lovers and things like that. So I felt like the message never really got to the people I wanted it to get to, which is I was trying to bridge the gap sort of between the mainstream and the environmental movement around a bunch of animal rights issues and environmental issues and things along those lines. And I never felt like I did it. So I was asking this question after I was done with that book, how could I find a much more sort of riveting and interesting way to kind of talk about the same issues and reach a wider audience? And that was just a question I had been asking myself kind of over the period that between Small Furry and my next book was Abundance, which I co-wrote with Peter Diamandis. And during that whole period, every 3 weeks or so, I would ask myself this question. And I had no idea what the answer was. And this is a true story. We're doing the press, the radio interviews for Abundance, Peter and myself. And we're in a friend of his high-rise apartment in New York City. And we've been doing a radio interview every 15 minutes since 5 o'clock in the morning. And it's like 5 o'clock in the evening. So we've literally done 50, 60 of these interviews in a row. And we're both really knackered. And I just got to get out of the apartment and clear my head. And I sort of run down to the street. And as I'm walking down the street, I sort of have this vision pops into my head of a human head decapitated, mounted on a teak chevron, and then hung on a trophy wall amidst a whole cluster of animal heads. And I literally like see this image of this head on human head on the wall. And I know intuitively that it's the answer to my question. And I don't have a goddamn clue what it means or how that head got on the wall. And that was in 2011. And the book, Last Tango in Cyberspace, essentially is a mystery, right? The protagonist encounters that human head on the wall in like the fifth scene of the book.
Yeah.
And the rest of the book unpacks how the hell did it get there, right? What is that about? And it literally, like, I had the image that started the book in 2011 or 12, and it took me until 2017 to be able to answer the question. And by that point, I had also discovered that I had this dying urge to write a kind of a cyberpunk sci-fi thriller, because most of the great cyberpunk writers had stopped writing cyberpunk, and I was really bummed because I love that genre and I think it's amazing. And I, you know, out of frustration that nobody was doing it, I wanted to write a cyberpunk novel in a sense, and I realized that these two things went together and actually formed the perfect book. So that's sort of, it was a long answer, but that's sort of where Last Tango in Cyberspace came from.
Now, as an author, do you think it serves better to you when you're trying to seek an answer to your own questions and write something that you want and you're proud of, or usually you try to kind of keep your eyes open what the audience will respond and kind of write it for a public in general? Do you think there's a better way to do this or not?
So it's a great question, and there's a lot of different ways people do it. And a lot of it has to do with how much muscle you have in the publishing industry and how much you're making off your books and all those kinds of things. Cause there's a bunch of economic concerns and there's a bunch of other crap that weighs in. That said, I sort of think of it the same way they do in Hollywood, where you make one for the studio and you make one for yourself. And that's sort of how you do it in Hollywood. And I haven't done this intentionally, but I have sort of gone back and forth in that way. Now, mind you, some of the books that I wrote and thought the audience would, Stealing Fire, for example, I had no idea. Stealing Fire was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, was a national bestseller, has become an international thing on its own. And I had no idea it was going to be anything more than kind of a cult favorite when we were writing it, right? So that was, sometimes they go in directions that you don't anticipate at all. But that's sort of how I think about it a little bit.
The one thing that I really enjoy in the book is that even though it is a fiction, you really incorporated some elements of today's societies in terms of the technology, the psychology, all of those little things there. It kind of mirrors a little bit the way we live today. So it's like not far off from our current reality.
Well, that was the whole point here. First of all, like, I don't know if you read the acknowledgments at the end, but every single technology in that book is either in existence in a lab somewhere or coming into existence right now in a lab somewhere. So the book's set like 5 years in the future? And I really, like, that was the question I kept asking myself. And it's Peter Diamandis, myself, and we're writing the third book in our series, right? Abundance Bold. And now we're writing a book called The Future is Faster Than You Think. And it's all about the impact of accelerating technology on society. And so I was in writing that book with Peter. I've been looking at what was coming, and it was shocking. Like, it's shocking how much change is coming so quickly. And I wanted to find a way to explore those ideas. And the same thing with the ideas that I was encountering as a, you know, as a flow researcher studying kind of the neurobiology of peak performance. And, you know, the stuff we're learning about consciousness and neuroscience and the ways that started getting folded into our world. I was really interested in exploring that stuff. So I sort of think, like, all of the ideas that are in all of my books sort of come together in Last Tango in a way that I haven't been able to bring them together before, because you can't do it in nonfiction, obviously, but you can link them together 5 years in the future really clearly.
Well, what kind of writer do you tend to be? You the one of those that you have to completely immerse in a project and there's no time for anything else, or you're able to manage it? Couple different projects at the same time while you're writing a book?
I have found that I can manage 2.5 projects a day.
2.5.
Yeah, that, like, literally, like, that's about my line in terms of big projects. And now, and it could be two books, that could be a speech I'm trying to develop or a course I'm trying to develop. You know what I mean? I have two big sort of creative sessions in me a day. And then I've got a little bit X left over. So as I go along, I always try to up the challenge level. I want to write harder books, harder sentences, try different things, really, you know, experiment in different ways. So, you know, every time I write a book, there are challenges that are, you know, visible to the reader, meaning like they're content challenges or style challenges. And sometimes I'm like, oh, wow, can I see this year? I wanted to see if I could write 3 books in a year, because I've never done that before. And so far, so good. I'm pretty close. That one I've never tried. So, you know, I there are those kinds of challenges as well.
During the process of writing this book, did you find out anything about yourself?
So that's interesting. And there's two answers to that question. The first is William Gibson, right? The classic cyberpunk novelist, really just a smart man in general, like, had a saying where he says, I love going out on book tour because I get to figure out what I've been up to these past 5 years. And there's something of that in this. Like, you have to wait for enough other people to tell me what this book is about for me to really learn stuff I haven't known before, right? Because right now I'm only seeing it through my perspective. That said, here's something that has blown my mind. There's a whole bunch of stuff in this book about how empathy works in the brain, in the body, in culture, what's the neuroscience behind it, how critical it is for the environmental movement, and a bunch of eco-psychology ideas about how we perceive nature and all that stuff, which was all roughly in a small furry prayer back in 2011. And in 2011, it was very hard for me to communicate these ideas to a more mainstream audience and for them to be super engaged. As I said, I've done 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 interviews around Last Tango already. The book hasn't come out yet. It's not out till May. But I've done about 5 or 6 of those, and I'm amazed by how much culture has shifted. The environmental ideas, the animal rights ideas, the empathy ideas, stuff that was foreign to culture in 2011 and 12 is now everywhere, and people are really resonating. They're like, oh my God, you're talking about all this stuff that we've been thinking about. I didn't know there was a language for it. And I've heard that over and over and over again. And what that tells me is that the kind of the level of environmental awareness in the world has risen dramatically over the past 7-8 years. And to me, that's one of the most exciting things. So it's not a personal insight at this point yet. Those will come, give me a couple months. But right now the first thing that I learned was a cultural one.
Now, because you have had many other successful books, how do you manage the expectation? Because there is a level of expectation, not only from you, I'm sure, but also from your readers, the people that have been following you, that this book is as good as your previous book. How do you handle that?
So there's another really good question. Yuri, you're fun to talk to. You're asking me questions nobody else asked me, which is great. They're totally fun to answer. That's a really long story, and I'm going to try to give it to you kind of quickly. One of the things I learned, first book tour and second book tour, is when books come out, two things are going to be true. One, they're very slow processes. Book tour, like, even if a book is a bestseller, you have to understand, like, there's all this excitement. Oh my God, the book is going to launch. It launches today. It's not like a movie where everybody goes and 2 hours later, they've seen the movie. They order the book and it sits on their shelf for a month, maybe 2 months. And then they read it, and then it takes another 2 weeks or a month. And these are the people who love you, who really get around to it right away. Right. So it's a slow percolation in, and you really want to manage your expectations through that, because it's always, otherwise you're just going to be disappointed. I also believe, like, you have no idea. This is a long game. So, for example, Small Furry Prayer came out of the gate, was nominated for a Pulitzer. Everybody thought it was going to be a mega hit bestseller. My expectations were through the roof, and it disappeared. I did well. And then a year and a half later, it started showing up on bestseller lists. What the hell, right? Like, it didn't do what everybody expected. My heart was sort of broken. And then a year and a half later, it starts showing up on bestseller lists. So I've learned you can never tell. And most importantly, I'm a creative. The thing I really care about is the next project. So I always start writing my next book before I finish the last book. Because by the time Last Tango is coming out, that what I'm going to do that day is I'm going to wake up and I'm going to probably be working on the book I'm finishing right now, the new book I'm writing with Peter Diamandis. And that's where my focus is going to be. And that's what I'm going to care about mostly. And that's really what it is. Like, I'm much more interested in the next project. So as long as my book does well enough that my publishers are happy that I keep getting to, you know, write another one, I'm good, in a sense. And everything else that happens with it, if it goes crazy, fantastic. Like, I care that it's a good book, but at this point, enough people have read it and loved it that I know I did my job. So what it does in the world, on a certain level, it's up to the world. My job is to put words together in a straight line, and that's what I care about most.
Well, what are the main things that you think has changed in the publishing world since you started writing to today? Because, you know, media has changed, the way you promote the book, everything else, much has changed.
Everything has changed. I mean, you know, when I started out doing this, bestsellers were created by a couple of good newspaper reviews, couple of good magazine articles, couple of appearances on NPR, and maybe one or two television appearances. And that was a huge deal. Now, NPR barely does books. Newspapers barely do books. Television is very, very hard to get on for books. And I instead do 60, 70 podcasts and, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff. And I like it a little. I mean, it's difficult now, but you get to take control of your marketing, right? I've got a huge email list filled with tons of people who love my writing, and it's great. I just have to email them and say, hey, I've got a new book out, and I can, you know, get it out into the world. And that wasn't possible. It's more expensive. It's more complicated. It's more difficult now. You get less support. There's less outlets for it, and there's way more competition for attention and in the book space. That said, there's much more authorial control. And if you are willing to get good at things like marketing and branding and PR and advertising and all these things that you never really set out to get good at when you become an author, right? That's not really what you want to do. But if you can kind of say, wow, this is my job too, you can start to take control of your destiny a little bit more than ever before. So it's a mixed blessing. It's a lot more work these days. And a lot more expensive and a lot more complicated, but you have way more control, and you get to reach way more people.
I really like the title. How did you come up with that?
So let's talk about what it means first, right? And then I actually had the title. I usually have my titles long before I have my books. And I had Last Tango in Cyberspace was going to be a totally different book. about totally different things, except for the same core idea. So the Last Tango in Cyberspace is essentially the end of something radically new. And at a small level, like what I'm talking about is the free sharing of information via the internet. And so technically cyberspace was novelist William Gibson's term for like the mind space produced by the web. So if you go back to the period of time, early 1990s, before the internet showed up, life had a certain feeling to it. It was a lot smaller. The globe was a lot smaller. The globe was a lot bigger. We were not nearly as connected. And once the internet showed up, you felt connected. The world felt smaller. It changed the way the texture of the world felt, even though nothing really changed, right? They connected some phone lines and started running, you know, new data through a new wire in your phone line. That was all that happened, but the feeling of the world changed. And that was sort of what William Gibson called cyberspace, right? He defined it as a shared consensual hallucination. But the most important part is that it's shared, right? And sharing information is useless if you can't trust what's being shared. And that's what's happening today, right? Whether it's fake news or control by big tech companies, the information we're getting is filtered. And as a result, our reality becomes filtered, right? And with the tech that's coming, this problem becomes a lot worse or more complicated. So that's the small thing I'm talking about. The big thing I'm talking about is the world as we know it and how the feeling, the phenomenological texture of the world as we know it, how that is changing. And a lot of that is because our technology shapes our reality in really deep and sort of not well understood ways, right? But the speed of exponential tech, Ray Kurzweil, who's the head of artificial intelligence at Google and has been phenomenal about technological prediction using exponential growth curves, has said that we're going to experience the same amount of change we've experienced over the prior 20,000 years during the next century. So this means we're going to go essentially birth of agriculture to the Industrial Revolution twice over the next 86 years or something like that, 85 years. Our reality, the way it feels, is going to shift into something really radically new and very, very quickly, right? And I think it's sort of doubly shocking because we're living in a world that literally didn't exist 20 years ago at all and didn't feel like this. The pace of life, all these unconscious things that really impact our days and our lives were very, very different, and they're all going to shift again probably in the next 5 to 6 years. So that's what the title is talking about, like Last Tango in Cyberspace, the end of something radically new. And one I'm really talking about is the end of like how reality feels and how the world feels to us. That's what's going to shift super quickly.
One thing that I really think about, and you just mentioned, is that there's so much information coming at us all the time. And there's also this whole idea that we want to optimize our performance and be the best we can be at work, with our personal lives, our bodies, our health, and all of those things. But one thing doesn't really go with another, right? I mean, I guess it's pretty clear that if you want to perform at a high level, you have to really focus and separate it from the noise and really kind of disconnect from this world that we're living in. Do you think as a society we will push back this whole technology immersion in our lives, or we already lost that battle?
Until we can start, brain-computer interfaces change what I'm about to say. But from a human performance perspective, right, and all the work I do with the Flow Research Collective studying flow states, we know flow requires long, so the state of optimal human performance, right? The state where we feel our best and we perform our best, and kind of one of the only ways we can actually conceptually process the speed and scale changes happening at in the world today, right? We sort of need the heightened information processing you get in flow to be able to deal with that stuff. But we also know that flow requires long stretches of uninterrupted concentration, right? The research shows that if you really want to do this work, 90 to 120 minute periods are sort of required. And that means no cell phone, no email, no instant message, nothing that takes you out of the task that you're doing. And that is not what the modern world is built for. And so I think there's going to be a pressure between human performance and the modern world. And I think the modern world was winning And now we're all starting to realize this, and we're starting to say, hey, wait a minute, we're not hardwired for this. Let's make our interfaces with these technologies a little, let's make them match with our biology a little bit more. So I think we're starting to see that. And I will tell you, I live in the middle of nowhere. I live in a tiny little town of 2,000 people in the mountains, and my cell phone doesn't even work here. I have a landline. Yeah, massively isolated. And I, you know, love the solitude and spend a great deal of time alone and focused and by choice. And I'm doing this while, you know, co-running three companies, writing books, having a full-fledged speaking career. And I'm doing it from the middle of nowhere. And I'm able to, you know, do this kind of work. So I sort of figure if I can do it in, you know, with the amount of kind of busyness and work and stuff that I'm up against, most people can probably do it. I don't tend to think, you know, there's anything super exceptional about me. I sort of figure if I can do it, anybody can do it.
Do you have a daily routine?
Oh yeah, I do. I travel quite a bit, and it changes. But my routine has been locked in, and it's built around a lot of kind of foundational human performance stuff, and it's built around a lot of biology stuff. It's built around a ton of flow stuff. But my days are pretty. Pretty much the exact same if I have any choice in the matter.
So what would it be like? Just give me like a brief version of your Wednesday. What would it look like?
I wake up at 4:00 in the morning. I am at my desk writing by 4:05 with like a cup of coffee in my hand. I write from 4 till 8 a.m. every day, working on whatever is my big book that I'm working on. I then hike my dogs in the backcountry for about 45 minutes to an hour, come back, eat some food. And then for the next hour and a half, I'm usually then like working on speeches or classes I have to give, or I'm podcasts, interviews, phone calls, admin stuff like that next block. I'll usually work till about 12:30, 1:00. I'll take a 20 to 40 minute nap. I'll eat some food. I'll do another kind of 2-hour writing session. Sometimes I'll work with my editor. Sometimes I'll just write. And then I will finish that, usually by going to the gym. And when I'm back from the gym, I will go into I have an infrared sauna, and I will read, for a half an hour, and I'll do kind of breath work, mindfulness, meditation stuff for about 20 minutes. And I'll come out, hang out with my wife, and go to bed and do it all over again. Pretty much the only variation is that when I'm at home, twice a week, I will hurl myself down mountains at high speed. So in the winter, that means I'm skiing. In the summer, that means I'm downhill mountain biking. And that's my life.
Well, it sounds like a good life to me. Well, tell us, what have you been reading these days?
Reading two great books. I'm reading I Am Dynamite, which is a phenomenal biography of Nietzsche. Absolutely incredible. One of the best biographies I've ever read. And I'm reading essentially a textbook called The Story of Psychology that is literally, it starts with the Greeks and it goes all the way up to like 2005 or 2004. And it's every single thing you could possibly imagine. It's like a 900-page book, and I'm loving it.
Steve, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And I have to say, outside biography and nonfiction, I don't read a lot of fiction books. But for whatever reason, I really enjoy yours. I truly enjoy it, and I want to congratulate you for that.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really nice of you to say. I totally appreciate that. It means I did my job, right? Like, I wanted to write sort of a techno thriller that was page turning and mind blowing at the same time. And just I kind of assume that most of my readers don't read fiction. Right. Most of my readers read nonfiction. So I wanted to write a book they were going to love as much as they liked my nonfiction. So wait. Sounds like I might have come close.
You checked that box.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Do me a big favor now. Tell everybody how they can find out more about you and when the book is going to be available.
The book is available. You can pre-order it now from Amazon or Barnes & Noble or IndieBound or any of those. And I'm easy to find. www.stephenkotler.com. Is how you find me online. Sign up for my email newsletter if you want. We're a couple weeks from now, we're launching a giant pre-sale campaign for Last Tango. So we're giving away a lot of cool free shit alongside the book. So check it out.
Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Cutler. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Yuri.
Hey, everyone. Make sure to like, comment, and let us know what you think. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.